Well, I got to Ottawa on the 3rd of July. The family stayed in Beaconsfield because our lease still ran, and we didn't have anywhere to live in Ottawa. And I figured that I could spend Monday to Friday in Ottawa and then drive down to Montreal and spend the weekend with the family. I got to Ottawa to find a hell of a crisis on hand. We were preparing the estimates, and the chief told me, he said, "Now look," he said, "you haven't got time to go around and make all your calls on, which is normal. You went and called on the other members of the Naval Board, because the controller was a member of the Naval Board. You've got to get right down to work on preparing the estimates with the rest of them." And he said, "We've been told we've got to reduce our estimates by $30 million.
Down from what figure do you
have? Well, I think it was down from about $290 million.
Really? So that's a substantial drop.
It was a substantial drop. Well, I had to work with the vice chief, who was at that time Admiral Jeffrey Brock, and the chief of personnel, who produced the bodies, and the chief of technical services, who produced the construction and the base maintenance and the black boxes that went into ships. And all that sort of thing. And I gathered my team around, and we started hacking away at this. And then, of course, we were meeting with the chief. And I found that I was staying with friends. I was working from the normal starting time in the morning till about midnight.
Long days.
And everybody, in the higher echelons was there, but there was nobody below the rank of captain working in the evening. The rest of them had all fled. And there were captains and commodores and admirals all running around trying to play the figures. And it was a difficult time. The treasury people from the political side were making us slash things. The same was going on in the Army and the Air Force.
Was this a program or the cutbacks that were happening at this time part of just a program to get rid of costs completely, or were they trying to get away from manpower costs and maybe go to different type of weaponry systems that were maybe a little more cost efficient? Or was it just a general cutback demobilization type program at this time?
Well, it was a combination of all these things. The government, in its wisdom, decided that they were going to spend less on defense. And one of the complications that had arisen at that time, which I became very much aware of, that the Department of National Defense and the three separate services were becoming top-heavy in their administration. Everybody was doing the same thing for themselves, but somewhat differently. And the result was that our support tail was getting very heavy, and the only place that we could chip away was in the sharp end.
Mm-hmm.
And this was happening in the Army, and it was happening in the Air Force. that was at that time the first moves towards integration.
Unification of the forces.
Well, the integration. Now, there were two separate things here. There was integration of facilities and what have you. In other words, the support tail. And then there was talk, but nobody really understood it, of unification, which was Hellyer's great thought. Actually, during my time at Naval Controller, the associate minister of national defense was a chap called Leo Kedzu, and he was a tremendous person to work with. One of the things that had always bugged me is we had a lot of, in our regulations, particularly on pay and entitlements and whatnot, we had a lot of what I called self-inflicted wounds, which had been generated by some little man somewhere who didn't know what the bloody hell was going on, but thought it was a great idea to shave something or other at the expense of the person concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I one day went in and talked to Mr. Kedzie, who looked after that side of it, and old Paul Hillier looked after all the Cloud Nine stuff. And I said, you know, we could help people tremendously by going through our regulations and tossing out all the irritants and the things that bug people and that are unfair in many ways. He said, go ahead. He said, all you have to do is you get the amendments, the regulations drafted and bring them to me and I'll sign them. That's what he did. And we were able to achieve a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back a bit, the Navy had inflicted a lot of problems on itself, which finally turned out to be very unfortunate in a way. We overdid commissioning too many ships, and in so doing, we totally upset what they call the seashore ratio. Now,
when you're talking about commissioning too many ships, what time period would you be talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the
mid-50s, or
the mid-50s to the mid-60s.
Okay.
We were terribly proud of the fact that we had the highest sea ratio of any navy in the world.
Really? Yes. I wasn't aware of that.
We had 60 ships in commission, from the aircraft carrier right down to smaller craft. But the trouble is that in order to man these ships, we had to reduce and civilianize the jobs ashore and get sailors of all kinds.
Such as the Lynn Creek incident that you were referring to previously?
Well, that was part of it. That occurred much earlier. But where this really hurt was that people who like to join the Navy, particularly people who make it a career as opposed to an in-and-out business,
right,
they usually get married, have family. And if they're never given a chance to serve ashore, they never have a sort of normal life.
Right.
Because our ship spent a lot of time at sea. And we reduced this down to where some trades, the engineering branch, for instance, particularly what we call engine room Kumar tipsters, who are the fellows who wind the wheels around and who run the they're all petty officer status. They very seldom ever got ashore at all because there was nothing for them to do. We had eliminated positions that had previously been filled by these people when they were not serving afloat, and put civilians in their place. And the same applied to cooks and stewards, and the only chance of a Jolly Jack got of getting ashore was when he went on a course to upgrade his technical level or his rank.
Mm-hmm.
And this caused this hurt, and it made a lot of problems. In some ways, this urge to commission everything that could float was a good thing, but we did keep in commission a lot of ships which were operationally substandard. They were painted gray, they had guns, and they had other things that made them look like warships.
Right.
In a war, they wouldn't have been that successful because they belonged to World War II.
At that time, they
were the state of the art was not that advanced. We were lucky, on the other hand, that we had this fine group of new ships, the Saint Laurent, Restigouche, and the follow-on. We had 24 of those, and they were leaders in the world in the state of the art. They were terribly efficient ships. Why, at that time?
Right.
Right now.
Now they're becoming obsolete.
Well, they're long in the tooth, and ships aren't meant to last forever. That seems to be something that people fail to realize.
Particularly in the government, as far as the armed forces is concerned.
Yes, and it gets increasingly expensive to maintain them. I mean, the same applies to the Princess Marguerite, which one of these days somebody's going to say, you know, the thing is only held together by endless coats of paint. and the naval fleet is in the same boat. And normally you work on a basis of a ship will be operationally effective for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're running ships that are running into 30 years.
That depends, I guess, on the amount of refits that the ship would go through, though, does it not?
Well, it does and it doesn't.
You can only refit a ship so many times before there's metal fatigue and it's...
Yeah, or you do a half-life refit and then but you've got to consider that it's what goes into the ship, the armament, the electronics, these are the things that you cannot continually put new ones in.
Right.
Because sooner or later it would be cheaper to build a new ship
than it is to keep outfitting with new.
And nowadays, the sophistication of the equipment is so great that you just cannot keep pouring new stuff into old hull.
Well, in your capacity as Rear Admiral Comptroller, was there any other effort investigated to pare costs without damaging the RCN extensively?
Well, yeah. Part of this was through what we call the integration process, where the aim was to bring all of, for instance, the paid services, the material supply services. We had already integrated things like chaplains and doctors and hospitals and lawyers, but that was peanuts compared to the other things. There were other areas that were being looked into, the base maintenance, you know, works and bricks, we used to call them that, and the transport and the military police and all that sort of business.
But when you're having to cut back $30 million out of the budget, I guess that doesn't add up to enough to account for the $30 million.
Well, I mean, some things cost a lot of money, lumps of money. So if you're going to save that kind of money, you've got to just slice it. I'll give you an example. I was discussing, it was my job to make suggestions. And the chief of naval staff was a splendid character, Admiral Rayner, but he had a minimal sense of humor. And he was terribly dedicated and serious, which I may have been dedicated, but I wasn't a serious type. And one day, we were sitting around in the naval boardroom trying to hack out these things. And I said, well, we have to make a start somewhere. I said, we'll pay off the Bonaventure. That was the aircraft carrier. He looked at me and he said, Charles, we're not going to pay off the Bonaventure. So I said, all right. But we had our boot camp, Cornwallis in Nova Scotia. And that was a first-class thing. It always did my heart good to go there, recharge my batteries. There were all sorts of cute young men with short haircuts and physically fit marching around, and the band played, and they were doing their stuff and learning how to be sailors. I said, we'll have to close Cornwallis. Charles, well, I'm not going to close Cornwallis. So then I said, well, we've got 10 minesweepers. We better get rid of them. No, we're not going to get rid of the minesweepers. So, more as a joke than anything. And I said, well, there's an item here, $50,000, to publish the history of the Navy in the Korean War. Ah, we'll strike that out. So, you know, big deal. We reduced things by $15,000.
That's quite an interesting attitude.
But anyway, we struggled through all this, and it was a very trying summer. And then the other thing that surprised me, I found that as a member of the Naval Board, I had to be on duty in Ottawa on an end of a telephone for 24 hours every fourth week.
Really?
There had to be a duty admiral. And most of the time, my wife used to come up on occasions where she'd take the bus up, but she doesn't drive. And we'd stay in a motel for the weekend. And I forget where the children were off, somewhere or other. Or else they came and stayed with friends. But most weekends, I just sat on the end of the telephone and nobody phoned me up because nothing was happening. And one time, I did get a call. And this was rather in the light of what happened afterwards. I got a call. The son of one of our naval officers who'd been medically retired, a captain, Jim Hunter, who was a naval aviator and a very distinguished one, his son was on a canoe trip in Algonquin Park and had been drowned, and they couldn't find the body. And the people at our naval air station at Sherwater phoned up and asked, they said, look, we will send our divers. And the Navy has today absolutely outstanding divers
Right.
And he said, we'll fly them up in a couple of trackers that have to do a training flight anyway. You know, they have to have their time in the air.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to be a capable aviator sitting on the ground. You fly the bloody thing. And they said, we'll do this without any publicity or anything. Will you give us permission? Well, I thought about it, and I knew that I could only make two decisions, yes or no, and I was 50% at risk no matter what I did. So I thought I knew Hunter, and I thought, well, this is a reasonable, humane thing to do. I said, yes, press on. And I think this occurred on a Saturday. Well, they were right there, you know. They were obviously waiting with the engines whirling around.
Oh, right.
The divers already with their diving equipment. And off they went. And at this point, I don't remember whether they found the body or not. But somehow or other, a Toronto paper got hold of this and said the Navy had come up to look for somebody's body and gone to the park and, oh, well, was this a reasonable thing? You know, the bills you get.
Right.
And Monday morning I went into the office, not thinking very much about this, and the Chief of Naval Staff sent for me immediately. He came in and he said, Charles, why did you approve this? Well, I said, there were only two ways I could go, yes or no. Well, he said, look what you've caused. Well, I said, isn't that too damn bad? I said, we didn't. It did not cost us anything. It wouldn't have happened. So I was assured that these aircraft would have been flogging around somewhere. And I said, why shouldn't they go and lend somebody a hand? Oh, he said, you shouldn't have done it. So I said, look, if you question my judgment on the only command decision I've ever been asked to make up here on a weekend, I said, I don't see why I should sit on the end of a telephone. I said, you know, get somebody else to do it and hope that he does the right thing. Well, the CNS was still sort of frothy slightly at the mouth, and I was mad as hell. But of course today, and for years past, the moment somebody gets lost or drowned or something, the first people they wheel out, whether it's a whole infantry battalion or a ship or an aircraft or something, it's the armed forces.
That's right.
And I was able to say that to Admiral Rayner after I retired. I said, you know, you got mad as hell about that, but I said, this is standard operating procedure today. And one of those things. But that's the sort of business. Well, then that took a couple of, I was 2 years as a naval controller. How are we doing?
We've still got a few minutes left to take here.
And as we advanced into 1964, the business of integration became more and more liable and imminent. And we were told that the Naval Board, the Army Council, the Air Council would be abolished on the 31st of July 1964, and one chief of defense staff and one chief of personnel, and they had other names for these people, and that would happen.
What was the general feeling at that time when they found out that unification was actually going to be implemented?
Well, it was tremendous.
Actually, that is the end of the tape right here.
Like,
maybe we should just leave it here and pick it up on the next interview.
Okay.